All right, we're back on the Fan pregame, a busy final hour. Yes, a final hour today, 2 hours every day this week, aside from Friday on the Fan pregame. Some fun discussions in the first hour. You can catch them on the podcast feed still to come. Bob Nightingale, this block, USA Today, talk a little Jays ahead of the deadline, and David Alter will join us in about a half hour. But first, the 152nd Open Championship tees off, you know, pretty soon here.
Here we go now.
At Royal Troon in Scotland. Adam Stanley will be covering the event for us at Sportsnet, and he joins us now. What's going on, Stanley?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How are you guys?
We're doing pretty good. We're a little bummed, though, when it comes to golf watching, because final major, mid-July. Like, I like when the major comes around early, but then I regret it when this is the final major. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I mean, final men's major. We got
okay.
Good answer.
Good answer.
This year in particular as well, we got the Olympics, men and women. We got the President's Cup as well at the end of September. So there is still some golf viewing to come, some big events still to come. But you're right, with respect to the way that they've kind of rejigged the schedule now with a little bit of a refocus on the FedEx Cup playoffs and no wraparound season. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now from our perspective, yeah, we've got 8 or 9 months until the Masters. It's a pretty long time. I'll give you that.
All right. So it's been now 10 years. Well, it's been 10 years the whole year since Rory McIlroy has won a major. And we all know what happened at the end of the U.S. Open. And we all know that he left the parking lot very hastily. And we know that he's since spoken. And we know that he was T4 last week at the Scottish Open. So of all of that information I just provided to you.
Good points.
Which direction are you leaning on Rory McIlroy this week? Does he have it in him to get near the top of the leaderboard once again? Do you have any confidence in him whatsoever, Adam, that if there's a 5-footer with the tournament on the line again, that he's going to make it? Because everyone saw the screenshots of that putt and where he hit that ball, and it was well above the equator of the golf ball. And I don't know, I'm not an expert on these things, but that certainly looked like nerves. So do you have any confidence that Rory can actually follow through this time and get a victory?
Yeah, that scar tissue it's getting deeper and deeper with each passing major championship. And I think also with each passing major where Rory has had a chance to win, I think it's going to become harder and harder to actually do it. You know, the very curious thing about Rory is that dude has notched a lot of yellow Wikipedia squares over the last 10 years. Like, it's not like he stinks at majors. And it's not like he stinks, like, period. He seems to just keep getting himself in the mix. You know, he's been a top 10 player in the world for this entire 10 years that he hasn't won a major. He's notched a lot of top 10 finishes. We kind of as a collective don't really care about the top 10 finishes. And I'm sure that, like, Rory and his contemporaries also doesn't really care about top 10 finishes at all. But, you know, from a zoom out general body of work perspective at major championships in the last decade, Rory's played them arguably better than anyone else. Brooks Koepka, you know, certainly is probably he is the winningest major golfer in this last 10 years. But, you know, from a let's predict a guy that's going to be there on Sunday perspective, you know, Rory, you just can't ignore Rory, but he's proven, and certainly recently, that actually winning one of these things, even if you get off to a great start on Thursday, even if you shoot the round of the day Sunday, even if you're right there for 3.5 days, you still got to do it. You still got to win. And you could still bogey 3 of your last 5 holes on Sunday to lose by 1. And that is what the most recent major championship on the calendar showed us. So, you know, to answer your question specifically, is he going to be in the mix 100%? Is he going to actually win this thing? That's going to be tough to say yes to.
Mm-hmm. Where does the Open Championship rank among the most or least winnable for Rory? You know, the Masters is definitely a bugaboo. U.S. Open he was just there in contention, and maybe there are fewer golfers who can actually win a U.S. Open because it does demand a lot from you. Is the Open Championship his best chance?
if it's not number one, it's probably number 1A. Like, the PGA Championship is pretty formulaic with respect to where they take that golf course year after year. And it's very, like, it's a very Americanized way of playing golf. And Rory has become absolutely spectacular at doing exactly that. Hit it as far as possible, hit it really high, and then try to make a bunch of putts. And I think Rory can do that with the best of them. From a Open Championship perspective, I do think that there's a couple more variables that you have to navigate around. Rory could this week get the bad side of the draw. Rory could get, you know, a bunch of really bad bounces and really good golf shots into greens, could end up in these, you know, terrible bunkers, and he's going to have to rescue himself from that. And an easy par, you know, with the ball in the air is going to look like, you know, a double bogey because of where he lands. So the question is it going to be is it Rory's, you know, easiest major to win? You know, I don't think so, just because there's so many extra variables that are involved week in and week out to win an Open Championship. I think the PGA is number one. The British is probably, you know, number two. The US Open is number three. And then the Masters is number four for me.
All right, we got to talk about Big Cat, because, yeah, I feel like I've resigned myself, Adam, to the fact that he's probably not going to win a major anymore. But then you see the video circulating on social media, and you see these stingers, and you see he hits it to 3 feet at the postage stamp, and you're like, oh, like, is this going to be the week? Like, I know the guy has to wake up at 3 a.m. to get ready for his 8 o'clock tee time, but, like, maybe this is the week. Like, does that even cross your mind anymore that he can win, or is it just, like, a blessing to be able to watch this guy play golf?
So, yes, it is. Certainly now, more than ever, it's a blessing to watch him just do it. This is the first time since 2019 the Tigers played all four majors in a season. You know, whether he's going to make the cut certainly remains to be seen. But the same question about Rory that we just talked about can kind of be applied to Tiger, and I'm kind of going to give a different answer. I think, number one, with a bullet, Tiger's best chance to win another major comes at the British Open. You know, he doesn't have to hit it as far as he normally would at a PGA or at a US Open or even at the Masters. You know, the greens are a lot slower at Open Championship venues, so that's kind of a great equalizer for him. He hasn't been getting the reps, obviously, in competition mode with putting, but, you know, the greens on links-style golf courses or links golf courses just aren't that fast as compared to the other golf courses he's played so far this season for majors. And then Tiger's intelligence level at Lynx Golf is higher than anybody else on the planet. And I think that he still needs to get the good side of the draw. He still needs to avoid mistakes. But, you know, this is a guy who won a British Open without hitting driver at all at one point. So,
epic.
You know, the intelligence level for how to play golf like this and how to win at golf courses like this, how to avoid trouble and how to have success, Tiger Woods is A++, and nobody else is even close to him. So I do think that gives him a chance, a better chance, the best chance out of any of the other major championships, just because he's just way smarter than everyone else at playing this kind of golf.
Oh, great. Now I'm excited again.
There you go. Yeah. So it's one of Tiger's best chances. It's one of Rory's best chances, maybe not the best, but close to. And also a guy named Brian Harman won last year, which means, like, you can be kind of
six.
What's that?
By six shots.
Yeah, by six shots, which means you can be kind of, you know, you don't have to be Hercules. You don't have to be Tiger. You don't have to be Rory. You don't have to be, you know, squatting 500 pounds to win this major. Does that make it more or less interesting for you that it's kind of the common man's major championship, where you can be less than when it comes to Rory McIlroy, Scottie Scheffler in that tier, and you can win this thing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that people were hot to trot to watch Brian Harman win by six shots at last year's Open. But from a Brian Harman and family perspective, they were fired up that he had a chance to win a major championship.
The rare Brian Harman and family perspective. You
know, exactly. But I will also say that somebody like Shane Lowry at Portrush at age 34 a couple years ago, you know, that was a grandiose, fabulous, everyone was excited kind of major championship that also kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, Shane Lowry's got all the tools, not unlike Brian Harman. Shane Lowry just happens to be one of the most beloved golfers, you know, on planet Earth right now. So, I think it's a little individual dependent based on who may be running away with a chance to win a major at the Open, but it allows for stories like a Brian Harman, you know, like Todd Hamilton, like Ben Curtis, like these guys that kind of came completely out of nowhere to just have their moment in the sun. But it also allows for guys, you know, like Rory and Scotty and Tiger and Bryson, obviously, and Xander Schauffele, mm-hmm. who hasn't finished outside of a top 10 at a major in 2 years, to kind of step up to the plate and kind of do the darn thing as well. So that certainly makes this major a lot more interesting. You know, the weather obviously is going to be a factor, as it always is. You know, these guys hitting creative shots that we don't normally see week in and week out, that's going to be another fascinating thing. Who can kind of just hang on the longest and hang on the best kind of makes this major championship super interesting too. So yeah, I mean, as far as who could win, wouldn't be surprised if it's one of the big names that we've long talked about. But out of all the other major championships, I think this is one where somebody might somebody could have a chance to kind of come out of nowhere and actually do it.
What did you make of the Colin Montgomery Tiger Woods beef with Montgomery saying, oh, maybe it's time for Tiger to retire, and Tiger snapping back and saying, well, I have exemptions basically because I've won and Colin hasn't won. So like this is just. I love that version of Tiger where he's just going to start snapping back at people all over the place because he's still playing and still wants to be out there and still wants to compete. And I get to be the one who decides when I call it quits.
Well, and Tiger has basically the ultimate clapback to essentially anyone that mm-hmm. chirps him about anything. He can keep playing the biggest events on the planet for as long as he wants. They even made a special Tiger Woods category for the signature events moving forward. Like, yeah, you get to 80 PGA Tour wins. You want to come play a signature event? That's cool. we got a spot for you. It's fine. But yeah, you know, Colin Montgomery, he said his piece, and I don't think it was too much like, I'm really going after Tiger with this comment. It was more so like, this is what I noticed at the US Open. And you zoom out and you look at how Tiger played at Pinehurst and what his score was. And yeah, it wasn't a great week for Tiger Woods. He was probably the first one to admit that. If you look at the transcript from that Friday, he basically said he didn't really know how many more majors he had in him. So he kind of admitted it as such. But you know, Colin Montgomery came out and actually said something in retort. And then Tiger was asked very specifically about it and said, I can keep doing this as long as I want because I want a bunch of them. Colin doesn't have that opportunity. So it was also, you know, Colin Montgomery's obviously Scottish and, you know, the European, the United Kingdom press is very, very different than anything that we have over here. A lot more tabloid central. So, of course, it made every headline and every newspaper over there. And yeah, gave us a little fire here before things got teed off.
It's like the golf version of Patrick Waugh and Jeremy Roenick. I have two Stanley Cup rings in my ears. Can't hear what Jeremy's saying. So. So
the 80 tour wins or that bar is difficult to cross. We're talking Adam Stanley, who's covering the 152nd Open Championship for us here at Sportsnet. We got to ask you about the Canadians, four in the field. Is there one whose skill set is particularly made for Scotland Lynx Open Championship golf?
Yeah. 100%, I think is the short answer to that. So the four Canadians, Adam Hadwin, Mackenzie Hughes, they both qualified for the Open Championship via some of their nice results at some particular tournaments this year in the Open Championship qualifying series. Dick Taylor as well is in the field, but Corey Connors is the man this week. I think we talked about guys that can kind of come out of nowhere and maybe have a nice run. And you know, we as Canadian, you know, golf fans and Canadian sports people, you know, we know who Corey Connors is. We know how well he's played overall over the last couple of weeks, but a lot of other people are starting to take notice. You know, Corey's now the highest ranked Canadian male golfer. Pick your list. World rankings, FedEx Cup, President's Cup. He's the top in all those. I think he's fourth in like strokes gained approach the green. He's seventh on tour in greens and regulation. He's comes into the week after a top 10 at the Scottish. He was top 10 at the last major he played at the U.S. Open. He told me a couple days ago before he went from the Scottish to the British, my game feels good. I haven't been playing this well all year long. His coach told me that Corey basically has been hitting it like the best golfer on the planet. And his putting is right now on the line between so good and great. And if he can just maybe lean a little bit towards the great side of things. He was first in strokes gained putting in the second round last week, shot the round of the day at the Scottish when he did that. you know, he's going to be right there. So, you know, the numbers are there, the body of work's there, the confidence is there. So I would not be surprised to see Corey Connors have a really nice week. Again, if he gets on the bad side of the draw, that's going to be the thing that probably holds him back a little bit. But as it stands right now, in terms of, you know, hitting the golf ball and the skill set you need to have success, he's pretty well dialed in.
Okay.
I'm excited to see what happens.
Okay, noted. We'll be watching Corey Connors this weekend and the other three Canadians competing at Royal Troon. All of Adam Stanley's work will be on sportsnet.ca. We'll be catching up with everything that you're dishing out. We appreciate it, Adam. And enjoy the rest of your summer. I know you're having the best summer, better summer than anyone, based on your Instagram feed. So keep it up. Continue enjoying your summer. It looks like a lot of fun.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate this.
That's Adam Stanley of sportsnet.ca. It's a scene, man. His Instagram stories are a scene. He gets
golf
to play
guy.
Everywhere.
Yeah, he's a golf guy.
It's incredible.
Yeah, he's having the best summer ever.
I'm just like, I just followed him this year.
Yeah.
He joined Sportsnet. It's like, oh, you're doing this every summer. Yeah. This is the normal summer.
You're on the East Coast. This week you're on the West Coast playing the nicest courses in Canada. Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. That's really cool.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
Let's
pivot to the Blue Jays a little bit.
Sure.
We're going to get Bob Nightingale in a second. But before we do, you know, we haven't talked in a while. Where do you stand on the Blue Jays right now ahead of the deadline? What do you want to see? What should be done? What's priority number one for you? Where are you at right now with this Blue Jays team that has fallen 14 games behind in the division, 9.5, I believe, in the wild card? We are at a pretty important time, and the Blue Jays are pretty much out of it.
How much time do we have before Bob comes?
Undetermined.
I can give you a 30-minute answer.
You might start cold notes, and then we'll see.
Look, the reality is staring everybody in the face.
Mm-hmm.
It is over. It's over. They're not making the playoffs. It's over. So what are you going to do? Are you going to sell Vlad? Are you going to sell Bo? Those are the massive questions. For me, they're probably off the table because you need players to play for your team,
mm-hmm.
and you need good players. And while they might get you something back, they're still only 26 years old and 25 years old, respectively. So it's not for me. But everybody else, if someone comes to you with an offer on literally anybody else on your team, I'm listening very attentively to it. I think now is the time to be heavy sellers for the Blue Jays.
So the Blue Jays are in a bad place this season, but not the worst place ahead of a deadline if you are willing to engage. So let's find out if they're going to engage. To help tee up the deadline, which is rapidly approaching, Bob Nightingale of USA Today. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Toronto Blue Jays, we kind of laid it out there. I'm not sure if you heard much of that, but yeah, they're out of it. They're not going to be making the playoffs this year. It's a massive disappointment because there were a lot of expectations on the Blue Jays this year. So ahead of the deadline here, we're under two weeks away. What should be the priority for Ross Atkins and company as they try to salvage this season with some transactions?
Well, at least this year it's a seller's market. So there's, you know, maybe five teams out of the race, six teams. So they should be able to get a lot for those guys. You can still hang on to Bichette and Guerrero. They'll try to go for it, you know, next year, but they should do pretty well as far as you know, the inventory they're going to get back just because everybody needs pitching help and some offense, and there's not much out there.
What do you think the Blue Jays should do with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette? Because I think everybody understands that some players are going to be moved at the deadline from the Blue Jays. Most likely or almost certainly, it's the guys that are not under contract next year and scheduled to be free agents. But Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has been very vocal about wanting to stay in Toronto, but the latest report suggests that the contract talks are not close. We're not sure how badly Bo Bichette wants to stay in Toronto, but both of them under contract for another year. How would you approach what the Blue Jays should do with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette? And what do you think they're going to do?
Well, I would think with the Guerrero, you know, he really wants to stay there. I'm not sure about Bichette, but Guerrero does. But yeah, anyways, I keep both of them. And then, you know, if he says, you know, he thinks he deserves more money, we'll let him hit the market next year and then say, you know what, we'll match, we'll go the high bid. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Yankees do that all the time. They did that with Aaron Judge. They weren't going that high. And then when the Giants went that high, they said, okay, we'll match it and keep you here. Same thing. I mean, Blue Jays have, you know, as much money as anybody, if not more money. So if they're not sure how much he's worth, go ahead and let the market dictate a year from now.
Do you not think that would be a bit of a risky course of action for the Blue Jays? I mean, Aaron Judge is Aaron Judge, and the New York Yankees are the New York Yankees, and Aaron Judge could have preferred other things, but if you want to play baseball in the most important market, and apparently Aaron Judge did, well, you choose the New York Yankees. But if Vladdy gets to the point where, yeah, there's other offers and the Blue Jays could match if they wanted to, I mean, they're still comparing destinations. He might have the decision between the Yankees and the Blue Jays for the same amount of money. Do the Blue Jays have that pull with him? Like, do you think he likes being with the Blue Jays enough to, hey, all you need to do is pay me the same amount and I will choose you?
I would think so. Why not? I mean, it's been pretty vocal how he doesn't want to play for the Yankees. So, you know, so you take away the Yankees. The Dodgers have Freddie Freeman. They're running after him. But, you know, the two biggest two teams in the market, the two teams with most money, if they're not being involved, sit back and they then you're competing against maybe the Cubs or somebody like that. But, yeah, you take your chances. I think the Blue Jays are in a great situation just because, you know, Vlad has said so often, you know, how much he doesn't want to play for the Yankees. You know, hey, he can't turn down a trade, you know, doesn't have that kind of leverage if they trade him to the Yankees, you know, which they're not going to. And, you know, the Dodgers have Freddie Freeman. They're not moving Freddie Freeman. So, you know, you're not bidding against, you know, many teams. It's almost like a Juan Soto thing with the Yankees. You know, and who's really bidding for Juan Soto, that kind of money? You know, two teams, Yankees and Mets, and that's it.
It's kind of an interesting dynamic in the American League East right now because while the Blue Jays are out of it, the Orioles, Yankees, and Red Sox all currently holding playoff spots, and you would anticipate that they're all going to be buyers at the trade deadline. So could we see, you think, the rare in-division trades? Like, are the Orioles, Yankees, and Red Sox potentially going to be looking at the Blue Jays as potential partners in trade? Or do you think the Blue Jays just say, you know, that's too close to home. There's a lot of competitive teams in the National League. Let's just ship everybody over there.
Well, I would think they'd prefer not to trade him in the division. Just, you know, looks bad, particularly if a guy's back in 2025 coming back to haunt you. But that being said, hey, if the price is right, if someone's willing to overpay, you know, the Yankees are, you know, pretty desperate. You know, why not move them there and say, you know what, it's worth it. And we've seen the Cubs and White Sox make, you know, recent deals. Verdugo went from Boston to the Yankees in the offseason.
Yeah.
So we're seeing it more and more.
So this market is pretty much concluded, Bob, that, you know, we're going to find out what the plan is in 2025 within the next 10 days or so, because the Blue Jays have a bunch of expiring contracts that they're going to try to sell. But they also have some valuable commodities that have term, like Kevin Gausman, Chris Bassett, Jose Berrios. If they trade one of those guys, they're basically waving the white flag on next season. So have you heard anything on the possibility of Gausman or Bassett or Berrios or someone with term for the Blue Jays potentially being dealt ahead of the deadline?
I mean, I'm sure you got to listen and see if somebody overpays. People love to have those guys. You know, you got a nice track record and everything else. I think you'll listen. I think, you know, all said and done, you don't move those guys because you still want to be competitive. You still want to, you know, win next year. So I just think they put them out there and see if someone overpays. You know, it's like the Detroit Tigers. I mean, it's crazy to think that you trade Tariq Skubal, but hey, if someone's willing to give them four or five, you know, top prospects, or, you know, make a Juan Soto type deal, hey, why not?
Who's the biggest name that you expect to be moved at the deadline? Is it Garrett Croce of the White Sox? Like, who's that guy that you think that is on people's radar as someone who could potentially be moved, and someone you think that actually, you know, will be moved? That's a pretty big name here.
I'll go Croce. And who knows what he has left. I mean, he's already pitched more innings than he has his entire career combined. So I'm not sure the team gets him. You know, what are you getting? I don't think he's going to be, you know, starting games in September, October, maybe pitching at a bullpen. It's more for the, you know, future, really. So I cannot see Skubal getting moved. I think it'd be crazy for the, you know, Tigers to do that. Look like Alonso's not going anywhere unless the Mets fall apart here, you know, down the stretch. So it's got a chance to be a lot of inventory, but not much quality. You know, we could have a dull trade deadline.
You mentioned that it is a seller's market, and there's five teams within 7.5 games of the wild card in the National League. So in your opinion, like who's on the brink there that if they make a couple moves could be this year's Arizona Diamondbacks? Like, I imagine this is what baseball anticipated when they created the third wild card, was to have this many teams, you know, competitive at this stage of the season. So who's the team that with the right ads sneaks it, can sneak into the playoffs and become the Diamondbacks of a year ago?
Yeah, I remember originally baseball 1 and 4 wild card teams. That would have been kind of
that's
a
too many. Too many.
yeah, particularly last year. You know, I think, I think the Diamondbacks have a chance to do what they did last year just by not doing anything. Jordan Montgomery's come off the injury list. He'll be better than he showed. Got Merrill Kelly coming back. Eduardo Rodriguez come back. So I think the Diamondbacks, will make the playoffs and could do what they did a year ago. Otherwise, we'll see. I mean, the Cubs finish up with the top, great stretch there in the first half. So, but I'm not sure what they're willing to do. A lot of teams, I think, they may not do much, but they just won't sell. So a team like the Cubs, who was planning to sell, now it's like, maybe we should stay pat here. We don't really believe what the Brewers are doing. So as far as the NL, wild card teams, I don't see a team like the Reds or the Pirates or, even the Cubs, or the Giants jump out doing something. I think their big move will just be staying pat.
But last one for you, Bob. Three teams obviously in a better position than the Blue Jays in the American League East are the Baltimore Orioles, New York Yankees, and Boston Red Sox, who are hard charging. Which of those three do you expect to be most aggressive in a pursuit of fortifying a potential World Series winner?
I would think the Yankees. I think of all those teams. For the Yankees, it's, getting to a World Series, almost World Series or bust. I think, what they've done, the talent they have, having Soto and Judge together, the pitching, for a while there was the best in baseball. So I think they'd be bitterly disappointed if they don't make the World Series. So I think they'll be the most aggressive. I don't see the Red Sox being that aggressive, but they won't sell. And I think the Orioles should go get another starter. They already made their big move, of course, by getting Corbin Burns in the offseason. But I think they should, get one more guy. But, I don't think they'd be as aggressive as, say, the Yankees or the Dodgers. I think for the Dodgers, it's not even getting a World Series anymore. It's win the World Series. Mm-hmm. So I think if the Dodgers don't win the World Series this year, be a colossal disappointment in L.A.
Yeah, and everyone we seem to talk to thinks there are multiple holes with that Dodgers roster. Mm-hmm. They may be the team that will be most aggressive, most desperate, and maybe the one the Blue Jays should have the direct line to if they're going to be able to effectively sell off their assets. It's a busy time, Bob, 2 weeks away from the deadline, All-Star break. We appreciate your time tonight, and enjoy a busy couple weeks ahead.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
That's Bob Nightingale of USA Today, MLB Insider.
I will be legitimately stunned if the Blue Jays don't move the most amount of players at this deadline. Like, Bob was talking about how it's a seller's market. Mm-hmm. The stars have completely aligned for you to rebuild your farm system. Like, there's rarely ever would you have such an obvious opportunity where there are so many teams in contention.
Yep.
They're all going to want good players. They're all going to come asking for you.
So the question
for your players.
The question then is like I'm in the Gosman territory now. Gosman, like, what are you?
Yeah.
Are you okay with moving those players?
100%.
Okay. So waving the white flag.
It's nothing against those guys,
yeah,
but you have to be able to see the forest for the trees. Like, who's on this team next year that makes you think they're going to be any better?
Yeah.
Like, no, that's the thing. It's like, okay, so he's under contract. Gosman's case is 2 years. Bassett's one more year. So Bassett definitely, I think, you have to look at that, because the chances the Blue Jays, unfortunately, are competitive next year in this division, given where they currently are, I mean, it would be a surprise to a lot of people.
And those two guys are highly competitive. Are they going to be cool with being on a bad team next year? I don't think it doesn't make any sense. Like, maybe they don't want the in-season trade, the families and the upheaval. Like, I understand that's a thing, but I think the biggest misconception about this market is that it will, they're not going to be droves to the ballpark every night, but that we won't appreciate as a fan base a team that is doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's what you want. Like, fans are smarter now. They want you to put them, give them hope. Let them know that you as an organization are doing the thing that is intelligent, that is going to put you back on the path to win a championship. Fans understand that now. Maybe before they didn't as much, but I think fans in this market will get behind an organization, a management team that is choosing the correct path. And it's pretty clear the correct path isn't let's retool for next year and just hope and pray.
It's such a great point because as a fan of the team, what would you rather go see? This current roster in September, you go down to the ballpark and you watch this current roster, a team that by that point is going to be 20, 25 games back of the division, 15 games back of the
playoff spot. No bullpen, maybe Chris Bassett on the mound. Vladdy in the middle of the order.
Sure, and that's it. Or you trade away some players that can actually get you some viable prospects back. You call those guys up in September and you get an actual glimpse into the future in September. Like for me, that's going to be exciting. If they can manage to get some decent prospects, some MLB-ready prospects, give them a look in September and see what the situation is ahead of 2025. That is more intriguing to me than watching a team that's in, not even the middle, in the basement, be 20 games back. Like, what is the point?
Hopeless looking up at Baltimore and New York and Boston now, which is
no-brainer for me.
They've got things cooking. We got to hit a break. We're going to talk a little Leafs. Haven't talked the Leafs offseason much on this show. We're going to do so with David Alter of the Hockey News next before we wrap up the show with some best bets. The fan pregame rolls on after this.
Covering the Blue Jays from an analytical perspective, Jays Talk Plus with Blake Murphy. Be sure to subscribe and download Jays Talk on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, final block on the fan pregame for a busy Wednesday. On this dark radio week, we found a way to make it busy. Toronto Maple Leafs appear like mostly done for their offseason. To discuss their progress, David Alter of the Hockey News joins us.
Yes, sir.
DA, we apologize for making you wait a little bit, but we appreciate you having on. We're coming on.
He looks frozen.
That is a frozen David Alter, I think. We're going to work on that connection.
Excellent hair and like, excellent blurred background. Fantastic.
That was really good. So we'll reconnect in a second here. But your reaction, Jesse, to the Maple Leafs seemingly being done after perhaps an incomplete offseason?
Yeah, I want to say I'm surprised, but goes against every fiber of my being, knowing who the Toronto Maple Leafs are. Like, it's just not an organization that tends to do big, bold things like that. If you look at the roster, it's, you know, it's been more or less similar for a very long time. The core is still intact. Obviously, the massive question is Marner, but it appears he's going to come back again. And I just wonder, like, where is the confidence going to come from that this team will be able to accomplish things that they haven't before? Like, is Chris Tanev enough? Is Bobby McMahon getting more of a look enough? Is Max Domi coming back enough? Like, those are the questions that we're going to have to try and answer over the course of the year. And I just don't know that the team is different enough to be able to get there.
Let's get David Alter to answer those questions. He's back on with us, the Maple Leafs. As Jesse laid out there, made some moves, brought some players back, lost some players for sure. Have they done enough to be better than they were last year, in your opinion, D.A.?
I mean, they'll be slightly better. There's no doubt about that, guys. But, you know, there's still questions about how much better are they really. If you look at the roster and the way they're constructed right now, you know, the forwards look like they're going to be the way they are, barring anything unforeseen and maybe a couple of minor tweaks and maybe a depth add. The defense is improved, but there's still just a couple of improvements. We still don't know about one guy. And the goaltending is unproven, right? Like, it's two guys who are good but have not played a lot and haven't really had to carry the load. And so you factor all that in together, and you wonder, is it enough? So I think it'll be slightly improved, but are they improved enough for the playoffs? That remains to be seen. We'll see.
Probably the most important pickup that they had during the offseason, Chris Tanev. And I think everybody sort of knows what he brings to the table. But how does it, what I'm most curious about, how does it impact Morgan Rielly? Because it feels like for the longest time, They've been searching for the right guy to pair with Morgan Riley. And it's not that he hasn't been a very good defenseman over the course of his Toronto Maple Leaf career. But I think the thinking is, at least if you can get the right guy there, maybe he is the number one defenseman that you've sort of been searching for years and years and years. Do you think Chris Tanev is that guy that can bring the absolute most out of Morgan Riley?
I think we're going to find out right away. It's going to be hard to say unequivocally just because Morgan Riley, as you know, has had so many different defense partners over the years. But the one thing they got Chris Tanev for was, in addition to his shutdown ability and everything, it's a right-hand shot that's reliable. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Morgan Riley really hasn't had consistently. There's been bits and pieces of it over the last couple of years with guys like Ilya Lyubushkin subbing in, and then, of course, Luke Shen in the playoff run that they had in 2013. But you factor all that into it, there's no doubt in my mind that training camp, when it opens, that they're going to try Riley Tanev first. And if there's chemistry and it works, then yeah, that's 100% what they're going to do. And then maybe they kind of figure that out. But, you know, as much as it's going to be Chris Tanev, it's going to be Morgan Riley as well. Does that fit? And if not, does someone else fit? And they move Tanev down. Tanev can play in any of those pairs. But really, it's going to be the Riley Tanev thing that everyone is going to be sure about. Remember last offseason, we were 100% certain it was going to be Bertuzzi, Matthews, Marner to start. Yeah. And then it kind of moved around. But we knew Bertuzzi, Matthews, Marner was going to be the start. So the same thing is happening in this case where it's going to be Riley Tanev, no question, to start. And then it's just a matter of chemistry from there.
Yeah. Morgan Riley not being a complete defenseman. He's pretty close. He's a really good defenseman in the NHL, but he's not a good power play quarterback. He's not a great power play quarterback. And for that reason, it seems since Brad Treliving got here, he's been searching for one. And I guess he's got one here, or he thinks he's got one, with Oliver Ekman-Larsson. This was definitely the most controversial of the moves made this offseason. It feels to me like Treliving is kind of blinded by his chase for a power play quarterback. Do you think Oliver Ekman-Larsson is going to give this team good minutes?
I understand that criticism, especially when John Klingberg was kind of brought in and it really didn't work out. And it's another one of those bet on the guy on the downswing that could go horribly wrong. I thought what was really interesting when we actually spoke to Oliver in his media availability was that he mentioned that in his last couple of years with Vancouver, when he was making the money he was making, he felt that pressure with the structure and everything that they had and what was being asked of him, that even if he was hurt, he was playing through it. And when he probably should have, you know, sat back and kind of taken the time to rest. Once the buyout happened, there was all that weight off his shoulders. He allowed his body to kind of fix itself. The Panthers weren't asking a lot from him, and he was able to kind of repair his game as he was needed as the season went along, and they elevated him up in the roster. And I think that's what the Leafs are banking on here, is that even though there is an expected responsibility, you're going to see him kind of bounce around between the second and third pairs. And if it's a third pair, 3.5 guy, that's not bad considering what the market for $3.5 million per year was. Look at what TJ Brody got in the offseason. Look at what Joel Edmondson got in terms of AAV for the roles that they were playing on different teams. I was stunned when I look at it there and I look at the market for what depth defensemen were getting. Outside of the term, I kind of understood it. So you look at that, the offensive ability, and just maybe the fact that the weight off his shoulders of the cap hit he was earning in Vancouver and it being much lower now with Toronto and kind of guys they can kind of implement around makes me feel like the Leafs feel it will be different with taking a risk on a guy who was coming off a down year, although you could say he was coming off a mid-year because the year before when he got bought out was really his low point.
We can talk about Ekman-Larsson. We could talk about Tanev. We could talk about Domi, but I don't think there's any question the biggest story going into training camp, the biggest story remains in the offseason, and the biggest story going into next year is Mitch Marner. And depending on what insiders you spoke to, the chances that Mitch Marner was going to remain a Maple Leaf ahead of opening night was pretty low. And it appears like, in fact, Mitch Marner is going to be in the lineup night one. So I'll start with this. How surprised are you that we are here currently in July and Mitch Marner is still a member of the Toronto Maple Leafs?
I am a little surprised. It, like the pressure was really on at the end of the season, and just given the way things kind of looked at the end of game four, that maybe all sides would have agreed that it was kind of time to turn the page. But now I look at it and I look at the stumbling blocks that are kind of in there in terms of anything that would get in the way of the deal. And there's just too many. There's not wanting to lose the deal. There's not wanting to sell low when you'd rather sell high. There's the fact that in my mind, there's a lot going on transition wise within the Leafs and Maple Leaf sports and entertainment that I feel like maybe as cooler heads prevailed, they kind of looked at the landscape and thought, okay, you know what? A lot more money and a lot more clarity within the structure of MLSC and ownership and a lot of other things are going to be clearer in 2025 than maybe in 2024. And maybe making such a catatonic move doesn't quite make sense unless something comes to them, and just a covertness about it and not wanting to upset the Marner camp, that as the days and weeks kind of went along, it kind of made more sense. And it felt like the inevitable is that, you know, Mitch Marner's got a year left, and it makes the most sense that unless someone really comes out of nowhere, it's probably not going to move along. But I think to me, the ownership and what lies in the balance there with Brendan Shanahan and everything at the end of this upcoming season, I think can play the largest role in all of that, because it all starts at the very top. And if that changes at the end of the year, maybe that's when it makes sense to make the biggest kind of change and direction within the club.
David, you've been covering this team for a long time. Is this as intriguing a storyline coming into a season that's ever existed with this team, at least in your time covering it? I mean, there are so many, not variables, because there isn't really any variables. It's just kind of elephant in the room stuff where this is happening, and I'm not sure how it's going to look, feel, play out with the fans, with Marner himself. He's never been great in front of the media. How is he going to deal with this? What is the response going to be? How PR is going to deal with this? Like, this is a big time story that is going to be absorbing every headline in the first few days of camp and into the season. Do you expect it to just kind of, do you expect them to get through it? Do you expect Mitch Marner to just get through it, that we start playing games and people forget about all this? Where do you think this is going to, what do you think it's going to feel like when we finally get back to Maple Leafs training camp and the season starting?
I think it's all going to depend on the team. I think if they lean into it and just address everything right away and just kind of say, and just kind of put the groundwork in and not hide from it or try to control the message too much, I think it'll be fine. My experience has been when you try to go away from the issue that's there, it never goes away. And it just becomes this big mountain of an issue like we're talking about right now. And it really doesn't have to be this way. And as far as intriguing from a player standpoint, yeah. But I mean, you're right. I have covered this team a lot. I've been around since maybe 2011. We've seen Salutegate. We've seen Brian Burkett dismiss his GM days before the season started after a lockout. There's been a lot of out of nowhere, shocking, intriguing stories with this team. It's part of the lore. It's part of the part of the fan fervor that is, you know, the Toronto Maple Leafs and where they stand within the National Hockey League as well. So, yeah, from a Mitch Marner standpoint, we haven't really seen anything like a homegrown player who's kind of been maybe alienated, depending on where you stand on the issues of all of this. But it's really going to depend on how the team approaches it. If they just lean into it and just recognize where the fan base is. I feel like a lot of times when there's been this run it back, it's been too much selling and not necessarily listening to the fans. And that's the biggest risk to me going into it is, okay, how much before people just kind of tune out the regular season for 6 months because they're just kind of sick of the run it back and kind of wait it out, and do the fans start being very vocal in the arena? That's what I'm kind of most looking to see if that actually does happen. We know what happens on social media, but social media isn't reality. I'm curious to see if it actually starts spilling out into the arena, and that's where it becomes really intriguing.
Yeah, and difficult to suppress. You mentioned 2011 or around there, meaning you've covered Mitch Marner's entire career. How has you know, the situation around Marner evolved. The discourse, the feeling, the attitude, the general pulse of his relationship with teammates, fans, media, everything. Where did it start and where is it now? Is it all that different than it was way back when?
Certainly kind of changed in the last year or so. And I don't know if that's the pressure, the mounting, no playoff wins or whatever the case may be. But generally, for the most part, you know, the star players had been available, but then there had been times where they wouldn't be as available as often. And then over the course of the last season, there was a month-long period where Mitch Marner decided to take a break from the media and not make himself available when requested. And then when he was kind of being combative, talking about how he doesn't listen to what the media says. And there was a lot of rhetoric that wasn't really pointed at one person in particular. And it just kind of seemed to be a bit of a distraction. And we haven't really been able to get to the root of that. And then there was, of course, this past week where he had the Mitch Marner Foundation. Mm-hmm. And you know, in past years, media would be invited to it. All that would happen. And then he decided to put in strict rules behind it and change that. And it starts to become a very dangerous precedent that he kind of feels responsibility, one that I struggled with, to kind of have to call out. Because if that's the line, what's next? And you kind of wonder. So you wonder, is this just him trying to avoid the scenario, or would it have just been better to just take a couple of questions and say, I'm not going to say anything more other than I'm excited to be a Toronto Maple Leaf this season, and everything else is not on my radar right now. And so that's all that really had to be said. But yeah, it's a lot of deflecting, which is what's leading to a lot of the intrigue and the anticipation of what's going to happen in the fall if Mitch Marner is still a member of the Toronto Maple Leafs, because it seems like there's been more of a separation, and I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing.
What's next is, yeah, it's the most appropriate question. What's next here for the Toronto Maple Leafs? What's next here for Mitch Marner? We're going to find out soon. Everyone can kind of plot and prepare and strategize, and that should be happening. Let's be honest. There should be some serious discussions happening to make sure that they can get through this if they indeed intend to be partners for the 2024-2025 season, which, yeah, it appears to be that way. We'll be looking for your feed and your work, David, all year long, because you're one of the best on the beat, and we appreciate you jumping on today.
Appreciate the kind words. Thank you very much, guys. Always appreciate it.
That's David Alter of the Hockey News, who, yeah, he's on the beat, dog on the bone. He's there, and he's got the news in Leafland every day.
I'm just surprised that with new management, with Keith Pelley coming in, and obviously the pressure that remains on Brandon Shanahan and Brad Treliving now being here for a couple of years, one of the most dangerous things for any organization is complacency. And I understand that they changed the coach. I understand that Pelley is now here. But from an actual roster perspective, it feels mildly complacent. Like, mm-hmm. It feels like with the Blue Jays, for example, you're bringing up like a Spencer Horwitz and a Ernie Clement, and you're like, oh, check out these shiny new toys. Like, these are the changes that are going to propel us into the future. With the Leafs, it's like, yeah, here's Chris Tanev. It's like, yeah, he's a good player. He's a good player. Oliver Ekman-Larsson, good player. Anthony Stolarz, sure. Yeah,
hopefully. Yeah.
Sure. But it's like, it's a lot of like, okay, like, why are they dressing up those guys to be sort of something that they're maybe not? Like, yeah. Has there been enough here that has been actually done from a roster construction standpoint, no matter who the coach is, to actually get somewhere where they haven't been before? Mm-hmm. And like, that's what they're trying to accomplish. They haven't won a cup since 67. I mean, got past the second round. They got past the first round only once.
Yep.
So it's like, has enough been done? And I just wonder if there's still that little bit of complacency there with the organization that they just haven't done enough.
Yeah, and it feels like, hey, we got the pounds of flesh. GM last year, coach this year. Oh, we'll wait for John Tavares to come off the ball. Yeah. Like, you know what, yeah. I mean? It just feels like resistant to make that change quickly. Before we wrap up, best bets, Patrick Cantlay is in a three ball with his buddy Xander Schauffele and Tiger Woods, which means he's only got to beat Xander Schauffele, right? Plus 180 is my best bet three ball for the first round. And I do like overall top former winner Colin Morikawa plus 320.
Well, I have Colin Morikawa to be the leader after the first round because he's 33-1. And I got to tell you, the guy's been playing some pretty good golf. He has won an Open Championship before, hasn't won this year a tournament, but he is playing some of the best golf of his career. So give me Morikawa to lead after one round of the Open at Royal Troon.
There you go. So we're all on Colin Morikawa. What could go wrong?
I can't wait to see.
We'll be back tomorrow. I guess we can commiserate around Colin Morikawa tomorrow. Jesse Rubinoff, Justin Cuthbert. This was the Fan Pregame. We'll see y'all tomorrow.